This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Mary Roach's latest book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. In it, she explores the science of keeping human beings alive in the extreme circumstances of war. Grunt examines the science behind some of a soldier's most challenging adversaries, panic, exhaustion, heat, noise, and introduces us to the scientists who seek to conquer them. Mary Roach recently spoke to me about her book and some of the more unusual research conducted to keep members of the armed services as safe as possible in combat situations. Mary, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me back.
Much of military science focuses on studying violence. What is your focus in Grunt?
Well, Grunt is kind of the other side of the equation, not the killing, but the keeping alive. So it's a book about the science of all these everyday things that soldiers deal with, from extreme heat and stress, sleep deprivation, flies, all of the just the day-to-day burdens of being out there in the field.
You know, speaking of heat and stress, do you think people are aware of how much soldiers are lugging in the backpacks they carry and the weapons they carry and the body armor they carry?
I don't think that people do. I mean, based on my assumptions coming at this from the perspective of somebody who's never served or doesn't know anybody who served, I was astounded. I mean, we're talking as much as 100 pounds when you factor in the body armor. I tried to just go into they had sort of a hot box that would simulate what it's like to be running across, say, a courtyard in Afghanistan with all this weight. And I had a mere 30 pounds on, and I lasted 7 minutes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I don't think people have any idea. And it's amazing what they have to do. I mean, they're not going on long marches the way it was done, back in the Civil War days, where you were actually on a foot march. You're in a personnel carrier for a lot of it. Nonetheless, even for just unloading, or in a firefight where you've got where you're carrying a machine gun and ammunition and body armor, and you've got to run fast and climb stairs because it's an urban environment. That's incredibly hard to do and hot too. You're getting very overheated very quickly, and that's dangerous as well.
Does that account for a lot of the injuries to soldiers, just the strain on the joints and then back?
Yes, there's a very high number of back injuries, not just from what's being carried, but also when you're traveling in an armored personnel carrier, and if there's any kind of a buried explosive, and that goes off under the vehicle. The vehicles are protective, but you're still getting slammed from below. And so this impact, particularly in the older vehicles where the seats were bolted right to the bottom of the vehicle, and that force would come right up and transfer right into the hips, the back, the spine, the neck, and the feet, of course. So there were huge numbers of back injuries just from that, not necessarily from the heavy load that you're carrying while walking, but just being seated in one of those vehicles. Lots of back injuries and lower leg injuries.
So what got you interested in writing about this side of military science?
It kind of an unusual entree to that world. I was reporting a story in India on the world's hottest chili pepper, and there's a particularly brutal chili pepper eating contest that goes on in Northeast India. And I was there, and while I was reporting on this, somebody told me that chili pepper, that very, very hot pepper, had been made into a sort of a non-lethal weapon, a chili pepper bomb, kind of along the lines of a pepper spray. So I went to this lab where they worked on it and developed it. And while I was there, just looking around, somebody was working on a leech repellent, which I found kind of fascinating and unusual. And so that was just this moment where I thought, well, military science is a lot broader and more esoteric than you might have imagined. It's not just weapons, bomb strategy. It's all manner of research that you probably wouldn't associate with war. And that, it just seems to me like a an interesting world to step into, something that, you know, a place I'd never really explored, and that always appeals to me as a writer.
You mentioned that a lot of military science looks at ways to keep people alive. How's military science using combat simulators as a way to train medics for all that they're going to have to go through and all the things they're going to have to deal with?
Yeah, there's a facility that I visited. It's in Southern California, not too far from Camp Pendleton, with Marine training camps. There's this big movie studio, formerly a movie studio, where they used to shoot action films. And it's been repurposed so that you can create these really very realistic warfare scenarios. And when I say really realistic, we're talking not just the pyrotechnics and the loud noises and the dust hits to make it look like somebody's actually shooting at you, but also the people who play the injured soldiers and Marines are in some cases amputees. They're people who are they'll have a silicone sleeve over their stump, and it's attached to a backpack, a concealed pack, kind of like a camel pack hydration system, but it's got stage blood, and you can control the flow of the blood with remote control. So you can, the person who's watching or the amputee, him or herself, can change the rate of the blood flow depending on how well the medic is doing his or her job. And it's quite realistic. And of course, you know that nobody's leg was blown off for the purposes of training. So rationally, those guys know and women know that it's not real, but it's very realistic and it's very loud, the loud noises. Plus you have the instructors kind of yelling at you. And the whole idea is to create a stressful environment in which to practice these sometimes quite complex life-saving maneuvers. So they think of it as they call it a stress inoculation. Like if you can do this with one-tenth the amount of fear, or maybe a third, I don't know how much, but if you could do it in that scenario, maybe you're going to be a little more prepared for doing it when things really go kinetic, as they say, and people are really shooting at you. Because as a medic, you've got to, you're in there being fired at, and you've got a weapon, and you've got to be expected to be able to fire back and to be saving lives, whether it's just pulling somebody out of the line of fire or actually performing these maneuvers. And it's a really tough thing to do under stress, because stress, adrenaline, the fight or flight response, fast and strong and dumb is how they put it. Yeah. So it's not, it's not a great scenario for operating medical equipment and doing sort of some precise finger work. You're equipped to get up and run, but cognitively you're not at your best self. So that's one of the ways to train medics and Navy corpsmen who provide care for the Marine Corps, that they go through this course. It's called Strategic Ops. Strategic Operations is the company that does these scenarios, and they're quite convincing.
Now, doesn't the Navy have something similar where they it's submarine training? This is what happens when a submarine gets a hole in it and it's sinking.
Yeah, they do. They've got a simulated submarine engine room, and this is at the submarine school in Groton, Connecticut, and these guys go in and they've got water under a tremendous amount of pressure, like what you would have if you were down, say, 50 feet underwater, and there's a hole that the water's coming in and it's a tremendous force, and you've got to seal off that hole fast. And so there's this replica of the engine room, and the rather sadistic folks who are running the controls, they will kind of start off with one leak and then another one and then a bigger one, and then the lights go out, and there's even one trainer that kind of rocks back and forth, so you've got to deal with that. So it is pretty high stress and realistic. And it's interesting, some of the remedies are things that have been around since the days of wooden sailing ships. Like there's certain kinds of holes where if you just you take a piece of pine that's in a conical shape, and you hammer that into the hole, and pine, it's a softer wood, it absorbs some water, and that seals you know, it expands and it seals the leak. It's a very simple, primitive but effective way of plugging a leak.
Mary, what were some of the things that, you experienced as you were researching this book, some of the things that you did as, part of your research?
Well, I traveled around a great deal. I did not deploy, obviously. I myself have not served in the military, but I was on bases, for example, in Djibouti in North Africa. I spent some time speaking to a Navy captain who was testing a new treatment for diarrhea, a quicker treatment, and which doesn't sound like it makes a lot of sense. Why would you? Why would the Army be particularly concerned with diarrhea? But in particular, the special operations teams like Navy SEALs, who are spending not so much time on the bases where the food is safe, but they're in small villages, say in Somalia, where the food may not have been refrigerated, the water may not have been treated, and they come down with some pretty intense bouts of gastrointestinal distress. And you could imagine if you're a 2-3-man team going to do a high-risk, high-security mission and you are hit with the rather extreme urgency that these things entail, you, I mean, that
can be a big deal.
It's a matter of national security.
Yeah.
So that was fascinating, you know, and, spending time with some of those men, obviously not out on a mission as they're classified, but at the base. And I was on a ballistic missile submarine out at sea, the USS Tennessee, and that was incredibly interesting. That chapter had to do with sleep deprivation and some of the things both the Navy and the Army are trying to do to address that problem.
What was your experience with maggots? Because I never knew the history behind maggots as a medical device, so to speak.
Yes, exactly. The maggot, as most people know, prefers dead tissue. It doesn't want to eat live tissue. So there was a discovery in World War I. There was a surgeon, William Baer, who kept seeing over and over soldiers coming in from the field who'd been out lying injured, were finally brought in for treatment, and there'd be these rather extreme open wounds, and they were the ones where they were infested with maggots. When they would clear away the maggots, he kept seeing this healthy pink tissue that had grown in and no infection. And it struck him that the maggots must be doing something beneficial in terms of healing and preventing infection. And he, years later, back in civilian life, tried this out. Turned out to be the case that they in fact do by eating the dead tissue. And of course, tissue is dead. It's not being served by the immune system. It's easier to get an infection going when you have a lot of dead tissue. The maggots themselves seem to be providing some kind of antibiotic in addition to just eating the dead tissue. And it's so effective that it's used even today at wound clinics, particularly with diabetic foot ulcers, you know, which are very hard to get any kind of healing down in the extremities, the lower extremities. The maggots are introduced, as you mentioned, they are a medical device. They are an FDA-approved medical device. There's a Medicare reimbursement code for live maggots. There's a prescription, a dosage. Yeah, they're kind of miraculous little creatures that don't get a whole lot of respect.
Did you try this yourself?
You know, I spoke to one of the researchers who's looked into this and has published a great deal on it, and I said, God, I'd really like to sort of try it out. Like, but of course, that would mean
as a good journalist, sure, you want to experience.
Because I had just burned myself on a Korean hot pot, but you know, you get those. It's kind of like a hot pot, and I had this wound, and I thought, well, wow, what if I tried it out? And he absolutely refused to consider that option. And I think thought that I possibly wasn't entirely in possession of all my faculties.
Mary, as someone who didn't serve, were the military folks willing to open up to you?
The researchers, yes, very much so. The folks that I spoke to at Walter Reed, the surgeons and the providers there, and some of the soldiers and enlisted men and women as well. But there were definitely times when I felt a little bit of a reluctance to get beyond the yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. So I don't blame them. I mean, I don't know. They weren't really sure like what I was up to, what I was looking for. Was this going to get them in trouble with their superiors? So the sort of default mode is to be just polite and businesslike. So it was sometimes a little, it was different. It was just a different dynamic than what I'm used to. But, you know, there were incredibly open individuals that I spoke to who shared their experiences and, you know, often quite moving stories.
Mary, what was the most interesting thing to you as you were writing the book?
Oh, it was all of it. It was all new to me, so everything was interesting. I mean, everything from, you know, being in an operating room, seeing somebody repair a urethra, you know, the tube that you urinate through, using a rectangle of tissue from inside the cheek, because that's tissue that is used to being moist. It doesn't degrade. It doesn't, you know, is not going to fall apart and deteriorate because it's moist all the time. I mean, like that kind of thing. And I, at the time, there were also some of the cadaver trials for the first penis transplant were going on, and I was able to observe that. That was unbelievably interesting. Like, not just the fact that it can be done, but how do you prepare for something like that? How do you figure out, you know, which blood vessels and nerves are the most important to reconnect, and you know, and how do you get to the point where you're ready to try that on a human being, a live one, that is. So those were two really interesting things.
Did you find that as you were doing the research, one story leads to another, and then to another, and then to another?
Yeah, that happens a lot. For example, the surgeon who was repairing the urethra, it was during a conversation with him. He said he had a colleague over at Johns Hopkins who was doing some cadaver trials for penis transplant. I would otherwise not have known to even look into that.
Yeah, you've got a lot of really interesting things in Grunt. I stumbled across one where you talked about how a zipper is actually a problem for a sniper. And I found that rather intriguing. I'm wondering if you can explain what makes a zipper a problem for a sniper.
Yeah, sure. I mean, a zipper, whether it's it's down the front of a jacket in particular, if you're a sniper, you may spend long periods of time lying on your front, you know, in position, waiting for some target to move into range and or just watching and seeing what's going on in a particular area. So you wouldn't want to be lying on buttons or a zipper. That would be uncomfortable. So this is a consideration for people who work in the fashion studio at Natick Labs in Massachusetts, where I spent some time. And the designer, the lead designer in the studio, was showing me this top that was a part of a sniper base suit, and I commented on that. It had this sort of sleek, fashion-forward look, and she said that's because it closes on the side. And the reason for that is that you don't want to be lying on buttons or zippers. And I said to her, well, what about, couldn't you use Velcro? She said, no, Velcro is loud.
It's
Velcro
true.
Might give away your position. You know, if you rip open a piece of Velcro, someone might hear that. So that, you know, that's another consideration if you're a sniper. It's really fascinating.
And that facility you mentioned where you saw this, that's actually a design research facility for military clothing?
Yeah, U.S. Army Natick Labs, they kind of make all the accessories that soldiers wear, carry. They don't, not the weapons, but the uniforms, the protective gear. It's developed and tested at Natick. So that may be anything from a boot to a whole system, a vest that carries ammo, batteries, all manner of things that you need on your person when you're deployed. So there's a lot of interesting facilities. There's a huge climate. It's like a weather chamber. You can create a blizzard. You could create 100% humidity, 95 degree heat. You could, you know, whatever you need, whether you're testing, you know, a tent to make sure it doesn't mildew, or something for a paratrooper to wear jumping out of a plane, or like whatever the situation is, you can create the wind and the precipitation, whatever it is that you need. So, I mean, and they've got like chambers where you can, you have sort of animated mannequin walking through fire, so you can test flame resistance. Really interesting.
Another curious fact from the book, Mary, and then this one appeals to my fiendish side. The story of the stink bomb that was being developed during World War II.
Yeah, that's right.
What was this about?
This was developed by the OSS, the precursor to the CIA. And the OSS was one of the things they were trying to do is come up with small, inexpensive weapons, non-lethal weapons, to distribute to resistance groups in China or France. And one of them was a little tube of foul-smelling paste, something that could be squirted from a little, almost like a little toothpaste tube. And that would be something you distribute it to these motivated citizens, and they would, when they'd see an officer, you know, let's say a German officer, they would, you know, sidle up and then squeeze this tube, and thereby covering this man's jacket with this very long-lasting, penetratively hideous sort of foul latrine smell. Well, there were different variations of what the actual smell was. But anyway, that was, and it was called Who Me, was the code name, the nickname for it, as in, I don't know, it wasn't me. I didn't do
who
it.
Who Me?
Who Me, as in who farted, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
And they, the correspondence back and forth in the file was declassified some years back. And so it was quite entertaining in that they had a lot of problems with the deployment of this particular weapon, and that there was a fair amount of dribble and backfire, so that the person who was administering the stink would then actually end up getting more of it on themselves. So it was pretty high comedy, as military records go.
So what's the message that you want readers to get from Grunt, to take away from reading the book?
I want people to be informed and entertained, but I'm also, you know, if people come away with a newfound respect for these men and women who are performing fairly heroic feats in their own way, you know, the things that they do are kind of unsung and under the radar. And it's, you know, if people can, you know, learn about their work and get a sense of what they do and how it helps, I think that's, you know, I'd be pleased if that were the case.
Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. Mary Roach, her latest book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War.